to grow barley in an islet, you have to accept that you're not going to make as much whiskey per ton of barley you use. And you have to accept that you're going to have to pay more for it because you have to get stuff onto the island. It's you're going to have bigger losses because of the geese and the weather and all these kind of things. But you also, what you gain is this incredible flavour and this depth and this character and this individuality and this lovely thing of supporting the community. So it's not just all about profits for us. It's all about, again, just doing the right things and exploring.
Coming back to the people also.
Yeah, of course. It always comes back down to people, for me, always.
We are Miriam,
Martin,
and Manuel. We love Scotland, travelling and whisky.
On our trips, we talk to the people to bring their stories to you and to share our love for the water of life.
This is Inside Whisky, the Barrel Talk. Today, we're lucky enough to be on Isla, and right now we're at Broichladi Distillery, and we're joined by none other than Adam Hennett. So, Adam, you are the head distiller here at Broichladi. Welcome. Thank you for having us today. And the first question would be, you are, and probably you're tired of these questions, but you're the successor of Jim McEwan. And I read in an article of the Whiskey Advocate that Jim was called the closest thing to Mick Jagger that the whiskey industry has. So if Jim is Mick Jagger, who are you?
Oh, well, thank you very much for having me on the podcast, Miriam. But I've got to say that's the best question I think I've ever been asked in 20 years of working in whiskey. If Jim's Mick Jagger, who am I? I honestly don't know. I've never had the chance to think about that kind of question, but can I get back to you with an answer on that one?
Because yeah, that's a really good question.
Okay, I'll have
just
a think.
Just throw in a random Elvis or something at some point in time.
Yeah, oh goodness, I'm not sure if I've got the knees to be Elvis, but I'll see what I can come up with.
All right. So, Adam, or maybe Elvis, before we dive into the distillery and whiskey facts, let's maybe talk about you beforehand. So, you grew up on Islay, and we as non-Ilach, we always think that whiskey clearly must have been a big part of your life growing up. So can you maybe talk us through how it was growing up here and mm-hmm. how you got into whiskey?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's quite an unusual thing, but growing up here, so Islay, there's what, 3,500 people here. There would be currently been about 7 distilleries running at the time when I was younger. Whiskey wasn't really part of day-to-day life. It really wasn't. I think you kind of took for granted the fact there were so many distilleries here. And again, I'm 41 years old, so when I was growing up, whiskey wasn't as big a kind of a tourist attraction or as big a how to describe it. It was there, but it wasn't the way it is today, you know, with mm-hmm. lots of tourists coming and visitors. So a lot of the distilleries wouldn't even have distillery shops or they wouldn't do tours. So growing up, you weren't really conscious of it. Mm-hmm. And again, when I was growing up, I just assumed that everyone had distilleries, you know, on their doorstep. And even although I would drive to school, so on the school bus, I would go from my house, obviously past Broichladi into Port Charlotte to primary school. And when I was in high school, the high school is in Inbermore, and you walk right past the distillery on the way to school. And we even did some of biology lessons, where, you know, about fermentation, and we'd go down to the distillery and see these things in practice. But it was part of life, probably more than I would think now I kind of think of it. But really getting into whiskey for me, I had left school and gone off to university in Aberdeen, to the northeast coast of Scotland. And after about a year and a half, I came back. I wasn't really kind of enjoying my university experience as much, and came back home and eventually managed to get a job as a tour guide at Broichladi. So Broichladi had been open for about 3 years. At that point, it was 2004 when I started, and I've pretty much been here ever since. I left briefly after about a year just to kind of try some other things, and they didn't really work out. I realized I really missed Broichladi, so I got the opportunity to come back, and I've been here ever since. So
you already mentioned it a little bit. You started as a tour guide, now you're the head distiller, so there must have been a journey through different roles at the distillery. Can you talk us through what you did, like all the roles that you had, and maybe what you enjoyed the most and what you enjoyed the least?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So I think, like I say, from being a tour guide to head distiller, there's a lot of different jobs I've done in between. Starting as a tour guide was great because you get a real sense of presenting the distillery to people who would come to visit and really understanding what we're all about. And when I joined, obviously, Bruichladdich was independent, so it was a really small team. And you know, Jim, as the master distiller, he'd be in the shop making sure that everything was, you know, the glasses were clean and the place was tidy and all these kind of things. So you got a great kind of introduction into the standards required and how we talk about Bruichladdich and you know what our mission is, if you like. So that's always stuck with me. And as I say, I left in 2005, briefly came back in 2006 as a warehouseman, which was fantastic. It was just a 3-month kind of period to help out before the whiskey festival, but I have been here ever since, so that's a long 3 months. But it was great from there. We actually, 2006, increased production and they needed someone to go into the mash house. So I started mashing. And again, with a small team, you had to be really flexible. So coming up to Christmas, we had lots of work going on in the bottling hall. So you finish your shift and then go into the bottling hall and do another shift to help get things ready. And I think, again, from there, we'd learn the stills and being able to kind of relief on the production's basis and the warehousing. You got to see so much of the distillery. And then from there, I suppose 2012, I started helping out Alan, who's the production kind of director now, but he was the distillery manager, so I got to help out with him doing the distillery figures and accounts and all the HMRC returns. And again, when Jim retired, I managed to convince him to let me step into his shoes as the head distiller. Yeah, I suppose it's pretty much I've done most jobs from, I think even actually I'm thinking back to when I was in the shop, I did a stint in the office as well. So a lot of the, we used to sell single casks, so a lot of that processing and speaking to customers and just doing whatever needed to be done. I think that's the thing that's really helped me, is just being willing to do whatever needs to be done to keep the distillery going.
Yeah, and it sounds like you probably just grew into that role that you're having right now. But was there a point in time where you thought like, well, I'm looking at this, what Jim's doing, that might be for me? Or was it just like, oh, well, there's an opportunity?
Yeah, do you know, it was a bit of a shock when Jim actually said he would retire. And I hadn't thought too much about my future or where I wanted to be. I was just happy being at the distillery and learning new things and progressing. But I don't think I've ever been, even as a kid, I don't think I've ever been desperately ambitious to do anything in particular. You know, I kind of nice and relaxed and go with the flow and see where life takes
whatever
me.
Comes up.
Yeah, and you know, I think I've always been interested in taking opportunities. And so, yeah, when Jim came in one day, we used to sit every morning in Jim's office. So we'd come in about 7 o'clock and we'd sit and have a cup of tea and discuss the day and, you know, what was going on and what we needed to do. And there was one morning Jim came in and we sat down with a cup of tea and he said, I've got some news for you, gents. And there was just Alan and myself and Jim. He says, I'm in 6 months, I'm retiring. Ooh. And we thought, wow, you know, even as a man who he must have been in his late 60s then, it had never occurred to me that he would retire. Which, of course, you know, it's going to happen at some point, but it never occurred to me because his passion and his energy and his just enthusiasm every day was incredible. And so when he decided he was going to step down, it was a real shock. But it was interesting because we split his role. So Alan, who was the distillery manager at that time, he became the production director and I became the head distiller. So Jim's kind of role was split into two. And really, from that point, you know, I had been working with Jim and, you know, helping him out with blending and learning things. I think he'd obviously been thinking about this for a while and had obviously, you know, been pushing Alan, pushing myself to try new things and do new things. And he was obviously convinced we were able to do it. And so that was it. He stepped down. so it was quite exciting.
It was probably quite exciting 6 months also to think like, okay, I have to learn this and that. And the time flies then when you have a little bit of pressure.
Absolutely. I think when you have that kind of, it's going to happen in 6 months and, you know, do you want this job? you know, you didn't really give me much time to think about it. But yeah, of course, you know, it was a great privilege to be able to take over from a man of his capabilities and his passion and experience. And he was great, though. He did say to me at one point, because I'm a very different character to Jim. You know, he's bursting with enthusiasm and shows it. He wears his heart on his sleeve, you know, as they say. In Scotland, he's very, very passionate. And you know, if you've ever done a tasting with Jim McEwan, you'll never forget it. You know, he's tremendous. And I'm probably I'm probably just as enthusiastic. I show it in a different way. You know, I'm a bit more reserved, perhaps. But he did say to me one day, he says, don't try to be me. Don't try to do what I do. Do it your way. You know, you are Adam Hannett. You do it your way. So that was really comforting as well. He was very good. Jim's great with people, and so he knew what to say. He knew how to, give me the confidence to go and do this job, which I've been doing for almost 10 years now. It was great to follow in his footsteps. But he did try and make it as easy as possible for me.
Nice.
As we're speaking right now, and you just mentioned you're here for 10 years as a head distiller, I'm pretty sure you've grown into the role. And for me, it is always hard to imagine what the actual role of a head distiller is. So I'm sure there's many different responsibilities to take on. So can you walk us through what your day-to-day looks like?
Is there such a thing as a day-to-day? Well,
you beat me to it, Maria. Yeah, absolutely. It's every day is different. And there's a wide range of responsibilities. So day to day, you know, it could be wildly different, the things we do. For example, today we have a visit from the James Hutton Institute. So we're sponsoring a PhD student to do some research into barley varieties and things. So they're looking at the croft land we have and, you know, thinking about seed breeding and the soil quality and all these kind of things. So I think for most head distillers, it will be about blending and liquid and samples pretty much all the time. But for me, I think at Bruichladdich, again, it's from grain to glass, barley to bottle. It's everything in between. So it's great that we have the ability to do everything on Isla, you know, as much as we possibly can. There's so many projects and so many things that we do more than we can probably fit in a day. You know, we do more than a lot of distilleries because we're really interested, really passionate into it. So I think working with the James Hutton Institute is fantastic because, again, we learn so much about the grain that we work with. I mean, making whiskey is barley, water and yeast and then maturing it. So it's relatively simple when you think about it, but the complexity that we have through the whole process and the every single detail, you know, you have to really investigate and look at and think of how can we make the best whiskey that we possibly can? How can we not just make the best whiskey we can, but how can we think about what's best for the community that we live in? You know, this small island is, we need to look after it, we need to support it, we need to think about, again, how we can look after the local farming community, how we can help soil regeneration, how we can do all of the things that, you know, there's a million and one things we need to do. So this is even before 10 o'clock, you know, and then so obviously we get lots of visitors and, you know, great folk like yourselves who want to learn more about what we do and tell the story, which is fantastic. So that's always something I'm always really happy to do and try and spread the message and talk about what we do at Bruichladdich and why maybe our whiskey is slightly different. But then again, it comes back down to making the whiskey as well. So, you know, keep an eye on the production process, the warehousing, but in particular the blending and the recipe generation. That's something that is huge fun, great fun. And again, at the moment, I'm pulling together some samples of new products coming up and experimenting with different variants of the Botanist. And, you know, the day is just so exciting. So I would say that there's no one day that's the same as the next, but there's a lot of ground to cover.
That sounds great, actually.
Yeah. It's good because you don't get bored. You're not sitting in an office doing the same thing every day. So you have, like, maybe someday you're talking about, I don't know, the grains, as you said, then the other day it's more about blending. So it's nice because it's different.
Absolutely. Maybe. Variety is the spice of life, as they say. It keeps you interesting. And yes, no one has ever been bored at Bruichladdich Distillery, ever, as far as I'm concerned. There's so much to do.
That's a good thing. So now we're talking about the distillery a little bit more now, and you already gave us a very long version of what makes Bruichladdich special. If you have to put it into three words, what would you say makes this distillery stand out from others?
Oh, well, do you know, it's part of a kind of motto, but it's people, terroir and time. I think when you think about sorry, I'm going to go on another massive long answer here, but the people are so important to what we do here. Yeah. And again, involving the community, not just the people inside the gates, but everyone around as well. The idea of terroir and focusing on your ingredients and you know, really championing that, where they come from, who grew them, what variety, again, the flavors you get, being allowed to express that rather than trying to maintain a consistent kind of flavor profile at all costs. And time, nothing in the whiskey industry ever happens quickly, you know, which is the way it should be. You need, if you rush things, you're going to make mistakes. So we take our time.
Yeah.
I mean, you already touched upon it. I think if you ever been to Islay, you can see that there's maybe some different soil, like wherever you are in the island, it is different. So can you expand on the terroir thinking you just mentioned? Is there like a farm that you say has a different soil to other farms in Islay?
Yeah, absolutely. I think wherever you go, whichever farm you're using, you know, they're getting the barley from across Scotland, there's going to be a difference. And we think about, you know, terroir, and we tend to think about the soil and the types, but it is more to it than that. It's you know, terroir is the concept of kind of every aspect that affects that grain, and we extend that into the distillation process as well. But we know, speaking to lots of the different farmers, again, the challenges they have, the soils they have, the, you know, the geese and the weather and all of these kind of influences that shape the barley. For example, last week I was visiting Andrew Jones at Cool Farm, and he grows rye for us as a regenerative kind of crop on his or a break crop and a rotational crop, which we of course make rye whiskey from, which is another exciting experiment that we do. But when we think about, he was interesting talking about the fields. He could see that the fields he had, some of them were waterlogged. There's a lot of water sitting on them, and the field next to it, where he had the rye, there was no water. So again, he was looking at that impact of how the rye is kind of absorbing the water and allowing, you know, as the roots go down, it's allowing that water to dissipate through. He's got very sandy soils. He's out in the west coast on the beach. So he was talking about, you know, the crops he sows to in amongst the barley to make sure that the wind doesn't just blow the sand away and the field disappears. So I think that's the great thing. Every farmer knows their land. They know what they need to do, get the best from it and look after it. And I think that's the thing, that everybody wants to look after their land, you know. And Andrew, again, his father worked the land before him, and he wants to take on that responsibility and I suppose continue that legacy and pass on to the next generation as well. So, you know, I think there's something lovely about it's more than just the land. It's the whole idea and the concept and the people. Again, it always comes back to the people behind it and what they want to do.
And let's talk about the barley for a bit. So you already mentioned there are different types of barley, you're experimenting, you're putting a lot of effort into research on these things. Now, could you tell us which varieties of barley you use?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a few different varieties. We use bare barley, which is probably the most unusual. Every year we work with some farmers up in Orkney in the Agronomy Institute up there, the University of the Highlands and Islands. And they grow bare barley, which is traditionally grown up there. It's a very different crop to the kind of more modern commercial varieties, like sort of on the malting kind of approved list of varieties at the moment. You'll find things like Laureate or Sassy, which we'll use, and that'll be the majority of the barley we use. You know, where we think of, again, allowing the farmers to choose which variety they think is going to suit their best, get the best yield for them as well, because it's important that we're not inefficient in what we do. But bare barley is a really interesting one because it's a very traditional grain. It's a 6-row head as opposed to 2-row head. So usually when the grains that are bred now, they have 2 rows of peas on the on the head. And that means the grain can be bigger, plumper, the plant can put more energy into those grains, whereas if you have a 6-row head, there's a lot more grain and they are generally smaller. So bare barley behaves very differently. It gives us a lower yield, but the flavour we get is incredible. And again, to get kind of geeky about things, but the genetics that bare barley has are very unique. You know, when you breed barley for certain characteristics, you kind of, a lot of the modern varieties the genetic diversity starts to go. They're very good. But bear barley, for example, will grow in very poor soils. It's early ripening. It has a tall straw. And so there's characteristics that you maybe do want and maybe don't want in there. But being able to breed with that, and again, this is where the James Hutton come in, being able to use these characteristics to breed different varieties of barley that will help us think how we can continue to grow barley when the climate is changing rapidly around mm-hmm. us. You know, we have probably just the same amount of rain as we've ever had on Isla, but it comes quicker, faster, and then we have longer drought periods. So how can we adapt to that? How can we use these characteristics? So that's a really interesting thing to be able to preserve. And again, if we didn't buy the grain or develop that kind of supply chain, if you like, and buying that grain for the bear barley, there would still be a little bit grown. But effectively, by wanting that barley, seeking that out, we've mm-hmm. able to kind of make it or commercialize it for the growers up there. So it's really good for them. Again, it allows the James Hutton, the Agronomy Institute to continue their research and learn more about it. And we find ourselves in a really good place because of it. Again, there's modern varieties. We'll think about not just the variety of barley, but also how it's grown. Mm-hmm. So we will use organically grown barley. We've been doing that since 2003. Which is really interesting. Again, that affects the flavor in a different way. And probably one of the most interesting ones is a biodynamically grown barley.
That's what?
So biodynamic is, again, it's building on organic principles, but really focusing on the rhythms of nature and, you know, planting at certain times when the moon is at certain phases. And it's a really interesting practice. And I would encourage anyone to go and have a look and dig into it a little bit more. And it's interesting for us because there's actually no biodynamic growers in Scotland. So we were interested in the practice. And again, it's a very kind of holistic approach to farming. It's all about, again, regenerative, looking after soil health mm-hmm. and these kind of things. And so we work with a farmer, Richard Gantlett, down in Wiltshire. So we've always, at Brooklady, since day one, thought about if we're making Scotch whiskey, we use Scottish barley. Mm-hmm. But there was a point about 2011 where, to explore this further, we had to make a decision. Well, is it important for us to just say we only use Scottish barley, or is it important for us to learn more? Mm-hmm. And so we have used this biodynamic barley, and it is incredible. And the more that we speak to Richard and learn about what he does, again, it's about sequestering carbon, you know, on his farm and his system. He used to farm conventionally, you know, the way that everyone else does, but he was always losing money, you know, buying fertilizers and, you know, relying on one or two crops. And so today he runs his farm in a biodynamic way. So he doesn't use any pesticides. He doesn't mm-hmm. use any kind of chemicals. He farms lots of different crops. He farms in rotation. And he farms with these kind of practices that basically allow his farm to sequester 10 times more carbon than the farming practice emits. Okay. So he's building the soil health, and he's you know, it's using the way he farms as a force for good, if you like. And again, the quality of his crops are excellent because he's taking into consideration the principles of nature and allowing them to work with them. So yeah. it's a fascinating thing. And this is the great thing about what we do. You know, you get involved in these kind of things, you learn so much every time. It's fantastic. Yeah. So
and it was probably the right decision to do something like that, like going out of what you said before, like just using the Scottish barley, but also to go dive deeper into what can be done, because that also sounds like the future.
Absolutely. Well, I think this is it. I think we take our responsibility very seriously, that effectively we are buying the product, the barley. And so we have a responsibility to ask for that to be done in the right way. Now, we know we can't just click our fingers and make everything wonderful, but we can invest in these kind mm-hmm. of things. We can support these guys like Andrew, who wanted to grow rye as a break crop, and we thought, well, we can make whiskey from that. And you create something just by wanting to do the right thing. So it's really important that we do that, and we support, but we also push for the right things in the right ways. You know, it's a really fine balance, a fine margin, but we have to do the right thing.
Yeah, and I think it's also working together, because you know how to make whiskey, but the farmers know a lot more about barley, even though you already know a lot about barley probably, they are the experts on that. And
absolutely.
So I think this knowledge is coming together at that point, and then you really need to put effort in on both sides to get something great out of it.
Absolutely.
And you're also using barley from Isla, so local Isla barley.
Yeah.
And you also already talked about the community. So do you think it's super important for a small place like Isla, just having 3,500, you said, people living here, working together in that way?
Absolutely. I think the whiskey industry is so important to Isla in many ways. You know, the jobs, the investment in the island, you know, the tourism and the spin-offs for it, the, you know, the transport companies, the ferry, everything kind of benefits mm-hmm. from this whiskey industry. But I think there's always more that we can do. And so at Brocklady, it was less about, you know, using the postcode, if you like, and mm-hmm. just saying, well, you know, because we make an Isla whiskey, we are good. We make great whiskey here. You know, we're part of that Isla tradition of producing amazing whiskeys. There's amazing distilleries and distillers and tradition on this island that goes around the world. But how can we benefit everyone here? And I think there's decisions that were taken from day one when Brocklady reopened about, you know, building a bottling hall here. Now, it's much easier for us just to ship our casks or our whiskey off the island to have it bottled and shipped, mm-hmm. you know, from the mainland. Much logistically easier, cheaper. But actually, you know, you go back 24 years on Isla and the unemployment level is very high. So, mm-hmm. you know, actually, let's take control over that process so we are doing it. We have full control. We get the things done the way we want. We use Isla spring water to reduce from cask strength to bottling strength. But we also provide jobs. Mm-hmm. And in particular, you know, when the bottling hall opened, it was, you know, disabled people who weren't getting opportunities elsewhere were, you know, encouraged to come in and help out. And so, you know, it was always about doing the right thing for the right reasons, you know, and then working with the local farmers mm-hmm. to grow barley. There was a lot of milk and cheese produced on the island years ago. And in, I think, 2000, the creamery kind of closed down, and so a lot of the farmers who had cows and involved in producing milk for the creamery, they didn't need the herd anymore. So automatically, they, you know, through no fault of their own, that income changed, the way they run the farm changed, you know. So it was really, I think, for us, two things. It was supporting the community, but it was also provenance and traceability in the barley, mm-hmm. you know. It's about getting that Isla flavour, that Isla character into the whiskey as much as possible. And so Isla barley was a great way to do that and great to work with the farmers. However, it was interesting, you know, they were all convinced and told over the years that you can't grow barley on Isla. It's not good enough. Mm-hmm. And there's an interesting angle to that, because if you grow barley on the east coast of Scotland, it's drier, you've got more yeah. land, it's more fertile, the weather conditions are better. So, you know, you maybe don't get the same quality in your barley in terms of, and I use the term quality in a way that I think the maltsters would determine as efficiency or mm-hmm. yield. You know, germination rates, nitrogen levels, all these kind of things. To grow barley on Isla, you have to accept that you're not going to make as much whiskey per ton of barley you use. And you have to accept that you're going to have to pay more for it, because you have to get stuff onto the island. It's you're going to have bigger losses because of the geese and the weather and all these kind of things. But you also, what you gain is this incredible flavour, and this depth and this character and this individuality and this lovely thing of supporting the community. So it's not just all about profits for us. It's all about, again, just doing the right things and exploring.
Coming back to the people also.
Yeah, of course. It always comes back down to people, for me, always. And, you know, we today, with the production level we have, it'll be, you know, based on the harvest last year, it'll be something like 50 to 60% of the barley we distill this year will have been grown in Isla last year. Oh. Mm-hmm. So depending on our production level and the harvest, you know, it could be more or less. But I would anticipate something around 60% for 2025.
Translated into a measurement like kilos or tons?
Yeah, so it's almost 2,000 tons of barley from the farms on Isla. And of course, there'll be, by the time that's malted, there'll be it'll be dried, there'll be a loss of a tonnage. But yeah, around about 2,000 tons.
Wow. That's quite a lot.
On Isla. It's incredible. I mean, yeah, we'll be
for
looking for
that. You cannot grow barley on Isla.
It's yeah, exactly, exactly. And look, you could the money we spend on that barley, you could probably buy more from elsewhere.
Yeah.
But what you save financially, you lose kind of in many other ways. So for us, it's just doing the right thing.
True. And one other topic on the production and the barley, and I'm not 100% sure if this is still the case, but I have read that you are also malting some of the barley on site with a technique called cellar-in-box malting. So I have never heard of that before I heard you talking about that.
Oh, right.
So
right.
Maybe can you explain what that is? Because I think quite a few people have not heard of that before.
Absolutely. Well, we're not actually malting our own barley on the like at the distillery yet. We've probably since 2001 been just about to build the maltings. So every year we're just about to build the maltings, but there's always the things like that we can't always control. And the plan and the will is still there, but there's always been other priorities. You know, we work with Baird's Maltings, which is a company up there. They've got a malting plant up in Inverness. And they are fantastic partners for us. They've been really supportive. And if you think about the barleys we use and the different experiments we do and the peated and unpeated and everything that we do, Baird's have supported that over the years. They've been just wonderful to allow us to do what we do. And they have a technique or they use a technique, the salad and box, that if and when we malt our own barley on the island, we would kind of employ the same technique, because a salad and box is essentially a box that allows you to steep the barley. So when it comes in, you need to hydrate it, you need to give it the water. So you could steep it in this vessel, and then you'd be able to drain the water out and be able to start the germination process in that same vessel without moving the barley to somewhere else. And then the kilning can also be done there as well. So it's a vessel that can do everything in the whole process. There are other techniques where you would move from the steep into the drying or onto the floor, and then from the floor onto the kiln. But the salad and box allows you to do everything all in one place.
Oh, sounds good. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I didn't know.
Yeah, and it's good as well because you have a batch size. You know maybe we could do smaller batches, bigger batches based on the size of the salad and box. So if we were to build a maltings here, we would build in a few of these that would enable us to do the smaller batches. So some of the farmers who could maybe only grow 20 tons, a minimum batch size for a salad and box would be about 50 tons. So, you know, allow us to get a bit more traceability from the growers who just produce a smaller amount.
Cool.
I always love our barley talks here on the podcast. Very in depth, but maybe let's look at the whiskey, of course, for a change. And Bruichladdich produces three different styles of whiskey, or mainly three styles, which is Bruichladdich, Port Charlotte and Octomore. And for you, what are the main differences?
Well, I think there's probably more similarities than differences, because we're producing the Bruichladdich, Port Charlotte and Octomore in the same distillery, the same techniques, the same equipment. The difference really with the brands is the peating level in the grain. So Bruichladdich is unpeated, which is unusual for Islay. So when we reopened, we were keen to get some of that peat in there, because again, as an independent distillery back then, we could do whatever we wanted. And we wanted to make peated whiskey too. So Port Charlotte was born as a kind of a traditional kind of level of peat, a heavy peat. And so it's about 40 ppm. So yeah, it's up there with the other kind of heavily peated whiskies. And then we created Octomore just to see how much we could push the boundaries of peat. And actually, it comes back to a story with the maltings, where what they do is they produce their peated batches as peaty as they possibly can. So they will slow the drying down. They'll get as much peat through as they can to really produce a really powerful smoky grain. And then to produce something like Port Charlotte for us, where we want it specifically at 40 ppm, they would take their batch, they would look at what the content was, it might be 100, and then they would blend unpeated in to give us that specific kind of 40 ppm, so that what they malt goes a long way. And that was really interesting. Jim at the time kind of says, well, could we make whiskey with the super heavy, concentrated, mega powerful kind of grain? And they said, no, we don't sell that. We use that for ourselves. And plus, there's no consistency in it. You know, one batch could be 100, the next batch could be 200, or the next batch could be 60. You know, we can't guarantee. So, you know, most distilleries want that consistent style. Jim was just determined to try it and push the boundaries and see what it tasted like. So Octomore was born just to see what would happen making the super heavy peated whiskey.
And when you get that peated barley from here to the island, is it always like, do you always aim for the highest level of peat, or is it you get what you get.
It's a good question. I think in the early days, what we were seeing was that every batch, every year we would get some of the Octomore and it was increasing and we were kind of seeing these phenol levels rise. And so when we started releasing the whiskies, you know, the first one was 80. And so that became the benchmark, if you like, of what Octomore would be. And then you would see it rise and rise and rise. And the most heavily peated batch we ever had was 309 ppm. And that was huge, you know, but I think what we've seen, and this is the great thing about the way we make our whiskey and the way we do things. Octomore is released, you know, every year as a new vintage. There's always kind of aspects we look at and focus on, but every batch is different. And we learn more. We know nobody had made Octomore before 2002. And so it was quite interesting to release a whiskey where we didn't have knowledge of what it would be at 10 or 15 or 20. And so it was kind of releasing these whiskies and people who were interested in it were drinking it along and learning with us, you know, so it was kind of like live whiskey making almost, you know. And today that still stands. And I think we've learned a lot in how we think about Octomore. Instead of it being this kind of arms race of peat to as high as we can, Octomore is incredibly subtle. It's got this, again, the similarities in Bruichladdich and its kind of fruity floral characteristics and where that super heavy peat smoke sits. It's a really interesting whiskey, and I think it's the most kind of experimental thing we do because we're able to focus not just on peat but on the barley variety, where it's grown, where we grow barley specifically on Octomore farm on Isla to make an Isla version of Octomore. We think about the peat level, we think about the cask types, and so it's more than just the numbers. And I think that evolution has come, and you know, maybe one day, you know, 80 has always been the phenol level, but what would Octomore be if it was 60 ppm in the grain, you know? Would it still be Octomore? It's like those kind of things we can think about and produce and learn from and develop. I think I'm not saying we're about to do that, but you never know, one day we might choose to do something like that.
You just take opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely.
You already said that maybe the three different styles are not that different. So would you say there is for you, a common tasting note through all those three styles?
Yeah, definitely. I think the way we distill and the long fermentation and the shape of the stills we use, we're always going to get quite a light kind of fruity floral style in that spirit with just a varying level of peat in there. So I think you're always going to get, particularly as we develop and mature Bruichladdich, Port Charlotte and Octomore, you're going to get that fruit character developing more and more. So there's kind of peach and apricot that will be, you know, kind of tropical fruit notes coming through in Bruichladdich that you will also find in Port Charlotte. You will also find in Octomore, but you'll have the peat smoke in there as well. So I always think of it like a family. You know, there's individuality in each of the siblings, if you like, but they all have that same DNA. They all come from that same place, so they do have a lot of similarities.
Yeah, I can see that. And I guess that those peachy and tropical notes are also very common in your core range. So
yeah.
Could you very briefly, I know it's kind of extensive, but could you very briefly walk us through your standard releases for each style?
Yeah, for sure. So for Bruichladdich, of course, unpeated, we would have what we call the Bruichladdich Classic, which is essentially a drawing together. It's a cuvée made from all of the good things we do. So there'll be Isla barley, organic barley, there are a wide range of cask types. All the things that we experiment with kind of almost come together for this classic to give us a bit of a house style. So from there, we'll have the Isla barley vintages, or the bare barley, organic, so almost kind of that barley-focused range where we can think about where the barley's grown, how the barley's grown, what variety of barley. And then we'll have some older expressions. We've released an 18-year-old, which for me is that kind of sweet spot in the distillery, you know, and that again has tremendous traceability and kind of provenance in there. So we're using, you know, Isla grown, we're using organic, you know, 18-year-old. We know it's more than just a number. It's a combination of all the things we do. There'll be a 21-year-old in our travel retail range as well. We make whiskies like Black Art, which is where we explore with the cask types we can use and really push the boundaries there, but don't always give you the transparency. It's a bit of a secret as to what goes on with that. And then into Port Charlotte, we have a 10-year-old as our kind of core range product there, and an Isla barley expression as well. An Isla barley vintage in there, which again is really unique, and you know, we get to focus on the differences there. And we also take the opportunity with Port Charlotte to focus on the cask. So we have a series of cask specials every year. We'll release a new variety, a new cask type, a new cask kind of finish, which is really exciting to see that development. And then with Octomore, we will release Octomore each year. Have a each edition, so we'll be releasing our 16th edition. We'll have a 0.1, which is our kind of control, if you like. It's a 5 years bourbon cask matured cask strength whiskey, or high strength whiskey, I should say. Then we'll have a 0.2, which will be usually the same origin of spirit, so the same PPM, the same kind of style, but aged in a different type of cask. So we can see the difference in the journey that spirit goes on, and focus on the cask there. We'll also have the 0.3, which is our Islay grown, Octomore farm grown Islay barley. And then we'll usually have either a 0.4, which is focusing on maturing in virgin oak casks, which is very specific, very interesting. And we can focus, again, we get into the detail and think about, you know, what is the species of oak, where was it grown, how was it toasted, you know, what size of cask, all of the things that shape the flavour. And if we don't release a 0.4, we would generally release an older whiskey, such as a 10-year-old, which is where we get to see the influence of age and how that has shaped and changed Octomore. So I think through the range, we're looking at pretty much every aspect of making whiskey that there ever was.
I was about to say, there's something for everyone on the portfolio. And
definitely.
What would you say, for you personally, what is your favorite style of the three, Bruichladdich, Port Charlotte, Octomore, to make, to drink, and to experiment with?
Oh, goodness, that's a good question. So to make, I think Octomore is always interesting. Because through the distillery, when you get that first delivery of malt and it goes into the mill and then into the mash tun, and you get that first kind of wave of the aromas of the smoke coming through, you almost start guessing as to what that PPM actually is. And we obviously send the samples away to be analysed and know exactly what it is. But there's always that process of not quite know. You're making it, but you don't quite know those levels and how things are actually going to end up. The other part of that was
drink.
No, they're all good, of course. And you know, I talked about these whiskies almost like children, like siblings, like brothers and sisters. So you should never have a favorite child. and I think to drink, I think to drink, it depends on the moment. I think there's times when only an Octomore will do. There's times when, you know, a Bruichladdich is the perfect drink. But I would say that for me, one of my favourite whiskies, and it's more of an emotional connection as well, was the Port Charlotte 10-year-old. Because when Port Charlotte at the moment is a very distinctive kind of single malt, but when we first released it, it was almost the peated Bruichladdich, and it was in the same bottles and the same kind of style, and so people didn't always know it apart, and we developed and gave Port Charlotte its own identity. And as part of that was really looking at, well, what's the best kind of thing? And so when I kind of took over as head distiller, this was one of my big early projects of kind of redesigning the range of whiskies and how Port Charlotte could best shape through. And I'm just so proud of Port Charlotte as the 10-year-old. So on a Friday night, that's usually my go-to dram.
On a Friday night, Port Charlotte is your favorite child.
And a Thursday night, and a Wednesday night, and a Tuesday night.
So we already talked about casks a little bit, and casks are really a vital part of whiskey making. Yeah. So could you tell us more about cask types that you're usually using here? So predominantly, maybe, not all of them.
We haven't got time to do it, to go through all of them, but predominantly we use bourbon barrels. So American oak really suits the spirit. You know, again, if you go back to the spirit we're making, it's light, it's gentle, it's fruity, it's floral, and the American oak really just looks after the spirit. And that's where we're getting those that kind of apricot, kind of peach, toffee, vanilla notes that all kind of work so well. Those tropical fruits are going to be developed really well in that American oak. We do use a lot of wine casks, which predominantly would be French oak. And again, I think the last count a while ago was something like 300 different varieties of casks we've got maturing in the warehouse. So we've got incredible variety. But if we just think about the oaks just now, predominantly American oak, we'll obviously, you know, kind of buy first fill, but also we'll use second and third fill casks in there as well. And then, you know, we maybe buy sherry casks and a variety of different wine casks. But again, always looking for the best we can possibly get. And the quality of the oak, I think, is always the most important thing. So not necessarily what wine was in there before or the prestige of that, but thinking about, well, what oak have they selected and how will that shape our spirit? Because the oak and the thyme and the spirit together, that magical part of maturation that even after 20 years of working here, I still can't quite describe and give it the prominence it deserves and describe accurately how it works. But that the magic that happens when those mm-hmm. two elements come together are fantastic. So we must make the best spirit, we must use the best oak, and we must give it time.
Coming back to time.
Yeah.
So coming back to the three words all the time that you mentioned before.
Always,
so
it's always good. Yeah.
So I was about to ask for these wine casks, because I feel like in the whiskey industry there are quite some wine casks around now, but I feel like at Bruichladdich you started early on with the wine casks. So for what specific reason do you think that the wine casks really work well with the spirit that you produce here? What is it that makes the combination?
It's a really interesting kind of thing, because traditionally the whiskey industry would use bourbon, it would use maybe sherry casks and Madeira port, or maybe some kind of fortified sweet wines, but there wasn't really a huge amount else. And I think when Bruichladdich reopened and we had some of the founders, Mark Rainier, Simon Coughlin, came from a wine background, so they knew about the qualities of the oak that they were being used. And Jim, of course, we were buying American oak. It was kind of plentiful, the ex-bourbon barrels. But Jim was keen to try the sherries and the ports, but couldn't quite get the quality. It's a small distillery. You know, he was looking for the best, and what was in the market wasn't always the best. And so with Mark and Simon, they were really keen to say, well, look, we've been working with the best, chateaus around the world, mm-hmm. with the best wineries around the world. We know the quality of the oak they use. Let's try some things. And again, that opening that up to Jim as a whiskey maker was fantastic, because he wouldn't necessarily have known where to go or what to use, but the combination of that whiskey expertise and that wine expertise just opened up a whole new kind of world for us, and we started experimenting and trying things. And I remember there was a 20-year-old whiskey we had, which was award-winning. It was 100% bourbon cask matured, and it was unbelievably good. And Jim released this whiskey, and it was, winning awards, and so he did a second batch. And it took incredible courage, I suppose, to kind of take this whiskey, this kind of, do we replicate what we've already done? Because we know it's one of the best whiskeys we've ever tasted. It's award winning. Or how can we improve it? How can we? And so that curiosity Jim had, he aged it in red wine casks. And, without knowing necessarily what would happen, knowing there was a risk. And so really over a weekend, Budgie, our stillman, who's been with us since 1989, he was involved in this and always tells the story that, Jim said, right, we'll come and check these on Monday, and after filling the cask on the Friday. And Monday came and went, and Tuesday came and went, and then Buddy said, did you check those wine casks? Oh, God, no, I need to go and have a look. So Jim, off he went and had a look, and not, wouldn't you know it, the whiskey using a red wine cask had gone pink. And for a whiskey maker of all these decades and years, you think, as he raises that glass and looks at the colour and thinks, oh, my God, what have we done? And having never seen that kind of colour before, but nosing it, tasting it, actually, wow, that has added a layer of fruit and sweetness and just complexity, and is, added so much to the whiskey. It doesn't matter if it's pink, actually. And we released that whiskey again. It won more awards. It was really interesting because of the color. People were, it made the newspapers, and people were talking about, us making pink whiskeys and for Valentine's Day and all these kind of things. And it was great for us to get kind of press and interest, that was one thing. But ultimately it doesn't matter what the whiskey looks like. It doesn't matter what people say. If you're making the best whiskey using the best ingredients and bringing new things in there. So really for us from that point on, it was all about experimentation, trying new things. And Black Art is built on the experimenting and adding layers of flavor from different types of casks and trying things that have never been done before. So even today, as we're making new versions of Black Art, we're doing things that we still have never done before each batch we make, which is right in the spirit of what
keeps
we do.
Keeps things interesting.
Absolutely.
I mean, you just touched upon it kind of being a secret, but could you maybe take us through a process of creating a new Black Art?
Absolutely not. Sorry. Black Art's a really interesting whiskey to make. And as I say, each edition that we do is unique. Each batch is different. And really, it's just about trying see new things, pushing the boundaries. And what we would generally do is take whiskey that's maturing in a type of cask, and we would, for its qualities, we would select it, and then we would add it into another type of cask to build another layer of flavor. And I think that's that's really at the heart of it, is building those layers of flavor and that complexity so that after years of doing that with those whiskies and blending and creating different things, you almost lose track of that story. You know, there's so many kind of chapters to that story that when you taste an edition of Black Art, it's quite incredible, just the depth and the flavor, and you know, just allowing that glass to sit in your hand to warm you, just nosing it. You don't even need to taste it, you know, just the aromas that develop over time and the layers that are and the flavors that are coming out of the glass are just phenomenal. So that's always what we try and achieve. Batch by batch, we make as much as we make or as little as we make, and each one we do, we can't ever replicate, you know, and that's that's a really lovely thing. It's always about trying a different angle, highlighting a different style, a different flavor.
And maybe can you take us through the process? Because I always think, oh, we're trying that. But at which point do you determine that the whiskey you're having right now is ready to release? Is there that moment, that aha?
There is, yeah. There tends to be, again, lots of different stages of whiskies that are ready or are not ready, and it's just kind of meeting them at the right time, I suppose. And again, allowing time to do its work. And when we need to release a whiskey, I think there's times where, you know, it would be great, can we release this now? And if I say, look, it's not ready, then we don't release it now. It is really all about the whiskey. It's all about that spirit and when it is ready. And equally, there's times when we find something is ready and we're not ready to release. We haven't developed the product. So what we can actually do at that point is take that whiskey and put it into older casks that have been reused a few times, and we can just allow that whiskey to sit and marry and know that really that flavor profile isn't going to change too much over the next couple of years, and with that whiskey is ready to go. So
then, jumping to something another whiskey or another release that is special, it's the Valange bottlings down in the visitor center. So the Valange bottlings are distillery exclusive, so you can only get them here on the island for the ones who are interested. And now there's always one staff member on the label of the bottles. So is that the staff member of the month, or how do you decide who's next?
It's interesting. Certainly, I'm trying to think how long we've been doing this, but Jim was still here. It was his idea to feature the staff on the Valange bottles. And if you go back to when we first started doing the Valanges, as you say, they were distillery exclusives. They were a reward, really, for the travellers who make it all the way over here, because it's not an easy place to get to. You know, any time we travel anywhere in the world, getting back to Islay is the hard bit. You know, like from Glasgow to Islay is the tricky bit. The rest of the world is easy. So getting over here is a bit of a challenge, and we want to have something for, you know, to reward people for getting there. So we would always have these kind of stories of, you know, things that were happening around the distillery, or you know, yellow submarines and all these kind of crazy things. We'd have different reasons for each label of the Valange. And again, Jim, a great champion of people, many years ago decided that actually let's just put staff member on, because none of this is possible without the team working here. So let's give, you know, Jim would be famous and in the newspapers and, you know, getting interviewed and things, but it's not just about one person, it's the entire team pulling together that really make things happen. So he started doing that in the early days, and really what we do now with the Valange is it's kind of like length of service, you know. It's it's those people who've been here a long time. Not everybody wants to be on a Valange. Some people are a bit shy and don't want to do it, but most people do. And we you know, there's Tony, who's one of the shift operators, one of the Mashman and Stillman. I think when we put him on the Valange, we sold most of the bottles to him so he could give them to his friends and his family. So
you don't get that opportunity every day.
Absolutely. But it's lovely. I think people are really proud, you know, to be showcased for what it is they do for the rest of us, you know, for the team. So yeah, it's really kind of what we do now is length of service and you know, the folk who've been there a while, and we try and make sure that we don't just have, you know, 10 people from the bottling hall in a row, that everybody gets a turn. So really nice.
We'll definitely have a look downstairs. All right, time to wrap up our episode. We always do that with some quick questions.
As long as you don't expect quick answers, that's
Here's the first one. What is your favorite tasting note in whiskey?
I really like a nice sweet tobacco, kind of rolling tobacco note, which is really distinctive in Brooklady, which I like.
Good. So now we're talking about the first Sunday at Fejile, which is Bruichladdie's festival day.
Mm-hmm.
What's the one best thing about that day here at Bruichladdie? What are you looking forward to every year?
The sun always shines. The party always gets started. It's the atmosphere and there's the fun. There's so much work goes into that day. You wouldn't believe, you know, even before the festival day last year, we were planning this year's festival. So there's so much work goes into it, and it's just a release to see the, you know, sun shining. So many people coming to visit. So yeah, great.
Yeah.
But in the beginning, we ask you which rock star you'd be.
Which you still have not answered.
I still haven't answered. You might have to come back for another episode and I'll think about that.
But now, which rock star band would you love to see on the Bruichladdie stage during festival?
Well, this year, I think my ask is coming true. So there's a group called Beluga Lagoon.
Okay.
And they're absolutely fantastic. Great kind of singer-songwriter and just fantastic music. So they're coming this year, which is going to be fantastic. So, yeah.
Nice. So you fulfilled yourself a wish.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
Good. Then, Adam, thank you very much for taking the time and also for sharing your knowledge on geeky things like barley and all the whiskies you have with us. And if you guys out there would like to get to know more about Bruichladdie Distillery or meet Adam and the whole team here at the distillery, I would suggest you make a trip to Islay and stop by at Bruichladdie. And in the meantime, you follow them on social media at Bruichladdie and visit their website at bruichladdie.com. So thank you for listening and thank you, Adam, for taking the time.
Thank you so much for making it all the way over here to have a chat with us. It's been great to meet you and lovely to be on the podcast. And yeah, I'll tell you the answer to the rock star on the next episode. Okay.
So we're taking that. So thank you very much. And we are Miriam and Manu. And this was Inside Whiskey, the Barrel Talk with Adam Hannett of Bruichladdie Distillery. Thank you for joining us on the Barrel Talk today. If you enjoyed this episode, tune in again next time for some more tales about the water of life. And in the meantime, follow us on Instagram at @inside_whiskey, on Facebook at @InsideWhiskey The Barrel Talk, or visit our website on insidewhiskey.de. This was Inside Whiskey, The Barrel Talk.